This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio and Progressive TV for those who are seeing it on TV. You can grab both of these things off our website at progressive.org. It's a great honor for me to have in this room with me today the one and only Salman Rushdie, author of Midnight's Children, The Satanic Verses, a bunch of other books, including his latest, The Enchantress of Florence. Salman Rushdie, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Just as we're gathering, you a couple days ago received an incredible honor, the best of the Booker Prize times 40, which means the winner of the author of the best book of fiction published by someone in the British Commonwealth in the last 40 years. Congratulations. How'd that make you feel?
Thank you. That made me feel good.
I figured.
It's better than not winning it. It's a wonderful thing. And actually, one of the things that made it nicest is that this time around, it was a public vote. You know, it wasn't mm-hmm. just a jury decision. People were allowed to vote on the internet and did so from all around the world. And it's nice to be the people's choice.
Yeah, I suppose. You know, I was reading your introduction to the 25th edition of Midnight's Children. In there you say about this book, that which was the prize winner, that maybe it's leaped the first hurdle toward, if not immortality, at least some life after your own. And yeah. So maybe this is the second hurdle.
Well, it's certainly its confirmation, because an enormous amount of the voters were very young. I guess because that's who primarily uses the internet heavily anyway, but it's just great to feel that the book, came out 27 years ago, but I started writing it 32 years ago. So there are people who were being born at the same time as the book was being born.
And why is it kind of existentially important for you to win this literary endurance race?
Well, I suppose writers like me, that's the game we're in. You know, it's a long game, literature. You want the books to endure. You want this shelf of books to be the thing you leave behind, and hopefully people will read your books long after you're gone. I mean, that's otherwise, it would feel sad.
I was talking with Allen Ginsberg about 2 years before he died in his little apartment there in New York City, and his view of it was, when I asked him a similar question, he put it in his terms that he wanted the wheel of Dharma to keep spinning when he was done, that the wisdom in his books, if it could lighten the load of living for people, that would be doing his job in the afterlife, which I don't know that he believed in.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not big on Dharma myself, but I've always remembered a great moment when Allen Ginsberg forced me to meditate with him, and there was a point where we were sitting on the floor with crossed legs with him chanting, and I thought, I'm the guy from India.
This is when you were in hiding?
It was the early days, yes, of the troubles, and he made me chant with him. And I thought, here's this New York Jewish guy, and I'm the guy from where this comes from, and he's telling me to do it. It was funny.
But he was more into it than you were.
Much more. He gave me leaflets.
Oh, God. He was a proselytizer. If we could just go back, I don't want to talk about this ad nauseum, the satanic verses and the troubles, as you put it, that were connected to them. But I read in a couple of interviews with you that you thought you only had 2 weeks to live.
Well, it was a very serious attack. I mean, and the one thing that everybody knew about Khomeini is that he was having people assassinated, sort of political opponents assassinated both inside Iran and outside Iran. So there clearly were professional death squads who had given these tasks, and they were rather efficient. So, yes, it did make me feel that the days might be numbered.
Do you know how close a call it came?
No, I mean, I know that there were a number of arrests and deportations in England during those years, which were connected with this. I don't think, I mean, they never got anywhere within sight, but there was certainly serious attempts. There was one explosion, there was one bomb went off in some kind of cheap hotel in London, which turned out to be to use the English political parlance, a terrorist own goal. somebody blowing himself up when he was trying to put together a bomb, which was not obviously intended for himself.
Was that going to be intended for you, or did they not know?
They don't know, but there was a suspicion that it was intended for me.
And of course, they did knock off a couple people who were selling your book.
Yeah, well, the Japanese translator of the book was murdered. And there were a couple of other assaults, which happily were not fatal. I mean, let's see, the Italian translator was assaulted, I mean, attacked, knifed, kicked, beaten, but did not die. And my Norwegian publisher was shot a couple of times in the back, three times, I think, in the back. But he also just miraculously actually survived.
So. And how were you able to keep doing your art?
You know, with difficulty. But I think I was very inspired by the example of other writers who had been persecuted. You know, I kept telling myself that I was by no means the first writer.
So, like the Russian
The Russians,
writers?
Yes. But, I mean, going back to, you know, Ovid being exiled, it's if you go, no matter where you look in the history of literature, you see that writers have quite often had a bad time with powerful people. And you know, Dostoevsky faced a firing squad. But most, you know, Genet was in prison. But most writers, or many writers, have risen to that challenge and continued to do sometimes their best work in spite of that. And I thought, well, if this is my share, you know, it doesn't mean that I can just cave in. So I was inspired, if you like, by the history of literature.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine. I'm interviewing today, of course, Salman Rushdie. I saw you give a talk in Madison, Wisconsin a couple years ago, and it was stand-up. I mean, it was stand-up comedy. And part of your writing is stand-up comedy. A lot of people don't understand the humor that is in all of your books, at least all the ones I've looked at. And so that's tremendously refreshing.
Well, I think, you know, I'm speaking as a reader. I don't find it easy to read books that are completely humorless, even very great books. You know? And so I hope that the books that I write do have a lot of fun in them. And I think anybody who's ever read anything of mine knows this. But for people who have not, there's a kind of impression that because the attack on the Satanic Verses was so unfunny, that its author must be unfunny too, you know, and that's, if you like, a residue of that attack. Because until that, if you look at the way in which my work was written about before the fatwa, if you look at the kind of reviews and responses that Midnight's Children and Shame, and actually even the Satanic Verses when it was first published got, they were all about humor, you know.
And then when I saw you were spoofing the fact that you've outlived by some distance now, the Ayatollah.
That's right, or getting on for 20 years now. Yeah.
So that must be gratifying.
That is extremely gratifying.
I view you, and I don't know if you view yourself, but I view you as an author, a writer, a champion of the Enlightenment. And it seems sometimes that the Enlightenment is under assault here in our modern world, wherever you look almost.
I think so. I mean, I certainly refreshed my knowledge of the Enlightenment writers a lot in the months immediately after the attack began, when I was, you know, when I had a lot of spare time suddenly, because I was locked away more or less.
A week of Sundays, yeah, a year of Sundays, got that.
But I did use some of that time to reread Voltaire and Diderot and Rousseau and so on, again, you know, took great strength from their example. And yes, I agree with you. I think that those values are under attack, because one of the things that was absolutely clear when doing that rereading was that the attack was an attack from, not from the state, but from the church. You know, the enemy was not so much a prince. You know, it was more likely to be an inquisition.
But maybe the church knew its enemy, because you have been writing about atheism, not even thinly veiled, in most of the books that I picked up by you.
Yeah, no, well, I'm fortunate in that I came from a very irreligious family. You know, my father was quite a scholar of Islam, I have to say, but he was completely lacking in any kind of religious belief. And my mother was not far behind, frankly.
And did they ridicule religion in your household?
No, it just wasn't there. I mean, there was one backsliding moment when they decided that they ought to perhaps give their children some instruction in Islam, and they hired a priest to come in at the weekend and teach us. And my sisters, who were much more rambunctious than I, started making fun of him. And he got really upset, and he went to complain to my parents, and my parents took my sister's side. And so the teacher stalked out of the house, and that was the end of religious instruction.
Rambunctiousness is something that you uphold.
Yes, yes, that's one of my chief values, I think.
I'd love it if you would read something from The Enchantress that relates to this theme of questioning God. So this is an incredible character. You have Akbar the Great, the emperor who is filled suddenly with self-doubt. Here's a line that he says to himself: that discord, difference, disobedience, disagreement, irreverence, iconoclasm, impudence, even insolence might be the wellsprings of the good. These thoughts were not fit for a king. And you have a passage that echoes that.
This is, yeah, this is a, if you like, a kind of series of reflections in the novel by the Emperor Akbar. And the Emperor Akbar was somebody who did question religion in the sense of, I think he, not that he lacked it, but I think he was a kind of pantheist and worried about religion.
I mean, he's a fascinating character in the book because he's all powerful and then he starts doubting and doubts a lot of things.
Yes, for example, God. He wanted to investigate why one should hold fast to a religion, not because it was true, but because it was the faith of one's fathers. Was faith not faith, but simple family habit? Maybe there was no true religion, but only this eternal handing down. An error could be handed down as easily as virtue. Was faith no more than an error of our ancestors? Maybe there was no true religion. Yes, he had allowed himself to think this. He wanted to be able to tell someone of his suspicion that men had made their gods and not the other way around. He wanted to be able to say, it is man at the center of things, not God. It is man at the heart and the bottom and the top, man at the front and the back and the side, man, the angel and the devil, the miracle and the sin, man and always man, and let us henceforth have no other temples but those dedicated to mankind. This was his most unspeakable ambition, to found the religion of man. In the tent of the new worship, the wine men and the waterers were calling one another heretics and fools. The emperor wanted to confess his secret disappointment in all mystics and philosophers. He wanted to sweep the whole argument aside, to erase the centuries of inheritance and reflection, and allow man to stand naked as a baby upon the throne of heaven. If man had created God, then man could uncreate him too. Or was it possible for a creation to escape the power of the creator? Could a god once created become impossible to destroy? Did such fictions acquire an autonomy of the will that made them immortal? The emperor did not have the answers, but the questions themselves felt like answers of a kind. Could foreigners grasp what his countrymen could not? If he, Akbar, stepped outside the circle, could he live without its comforting circularity in the terrifying strangeness of a new thought?
That's Salman Rushdie, of course, reading from his latest work, The Enchantress of Florence. I wanted to ask you about a petition, a manifesto you signed against Islamism that was comparing the dangers of Islamism with Nazism and Stalinism.
Mm-hmm.
One question is why the term Islamism, because it seems to encompass the whole religion.
Well, the term, I sort of agree with you. I'm not sure about the value of the term, but the term grew up as a way of distinguishing ordinary religious belief from the political manifestation of Islam, and that the Islamist project was basically a religious political project, and that specifically is what we were trying to point out the dangers of, and I do think it's very comparable. I mean, the word fascist is not inappropriate, I think, to the way in which, for instance, minority groups are treated. I mean, you know, the Nazis were famously hostile not only to the Jews but also to Gypsies and other minorities, and inside Islam there is vicious antipathy amongst these political Islamists to members of other religions, but also homosexuals, Jews, all kinds of other minority groups, and the treatment of them has been vicious. I mean, one of the things that happened soon after the Khomeini Revolution was the execution of very large numbers of homosexuals and prostitutes, for instance. You know, so that's very comparable. And I think that this is an authoritarian radical, highly motivated, very dangerous project that may well be, in our time, the most dangerous ideology in the world.
And now, several years after 9/11, is it waxing or waning?
I don't know. I'm not sure, actually. I think maybe both at the same time in different parts of the world. I think it's interesting that there are some signs that even inside Al-Qaeda, there seem to be some splits appearing, and there seem to be some members of it who have made statements questioning the value of the violent road. I certainly think that if you look at Iraq, one of the interesting things is the rejection of Al-Qaeda by Iraqis. And
by Sunni Iraqis.
By Sunni Iraqis, mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think there is evidence that this may be a short-lived phenomenon. You know, and it seems to me another piece of evidence is that everywhere in the world that Islamist radicalism has really got into control, you know, whether it's Afghanistan or Algeria or Iran, those are the places where it's most hated. Mm. You know, so it may be that when people have a good look at this thing in the Muslim world, they discover that they really, really don't want it.
I mean, I think that's one thing that American audiences need to focus on, because they just think in those countries, the whole country is Islamic fundamentalist.
No, because you know, if you look at who is most persecuted by Islamic fundamentalists, it starts off with being other Muslims. You know, the people who were persecuted most by the Taliban were the Muslims of Afghanistan. You know, the people who are now persecuted by the Ayatollahs of Iran are the people of Iran. You know, in Iraq today, the most people being killed by radical suicide bombing are other Muslims. Mm. You know, I mean, the number of Americans and British soldiers being killed is minute compared to the number of Muslims being killed.
Salman Rushdie, you raised the question of Iraq. Before the war started, you were ambivalent in a couple things I saw. You said a good case could be made for overthrowing Saddam Hussein because of his brutality and dictatorial rule. And yet you weren't foursquare, certainly, behind the Bush administration and its rationalization.
I certainly think there is a good case to be made for the deposition of Saddam Hussein, but they didn't make it. You know, I said that in order to do that, you would have to build a coalition. You'd have to. I mean, if you look at the attack on Afghanistan, there was a coalition of sympathy for that attack, which included many Muslim countries as well. And if you'd been able to put together that kind of a body of agreement about the deposition of Saddam, and if it was supposed to be about getting rid of a tyrant rather than the fiction of attacking a country because of weapons it didn't possess.
Did you know it was a fiction at the time?
Well, no, I didn't, but it's not interesting. It's not attractive to be lied to.
Certainly not.
And I think we were lied to on both sides of the Atlantic. And I think it's you know, one of the reasons for the enormous rejection of Tony Blair by the British electorate was that they didn't care to be lied to. You know, it's strange because clearly he was in many ways an effective prime minister. You know, and the country was actually very well run in many ways under Blair, and yet that single crime, if you like, that single political misjudgment destroyed him.
And yet Bush has not been destroyed by it, though his popularity has gone way down.
You have greater difficulty getting rid of presidents than we do. And that may be just a structural problem.
You know, Salman Rushdie, I was reading Midnight's Children the other day, and I came across this line, cocksure men do terrible deeds. Mm-hmm. And the image of George Bush leapt straight to mind. Well, what is your assessment of the man?
Well, I think he's somebody who has done more damage to this country's position in the world than any other president in history. And I think it's going to take a long while to recover from it. Now, I'm going to correct that, actually. It need not take a long while. And I think one of the things that the world is looking, the reason why the world is so unusually interested in this particular American election is because, in a sense, whoever's president of America is president of the world, you know, and affects the world very profoundly.
You know, Eduardo Galeano wants everyone in the world to be able to vote.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, I can see that as a kind of rhetorical position. It ain't going to happen, is it? but it's true that I think people are very anxious to see that America in the next 4-8 years is going to go down a different road than the one it's been going down in the last 8 years. And that's why there's such intense interest in the election. More coverage, more ink, you know, more column inches covering this election than there's ever been before, because people want to see if there's going to be a change.
And is it true that the preponderance of that opinion is pro-Obama?
Yeah, yeah, there's no question of it. I think, and that was true even before Obama was, you know, had won the battle, because I think Hillary, as well as McCain, felt like not that much of a change, mm-hmm. you know, and Obama was the candidate who looked like a change, and so that's made him unusually popular. Yeah.
And certainly he's more of a multilateralist than Bush is, and that McCain seems to be. On some fundamental issues, he may not be that much different. In
yes, who
policy.
Knows? I mean, who knows? I think the test of a president is always in the doing, you know, but I think he does have this, this unusual, unusually inspiring quality, and that one hasn't seen in a not just an American political candidate, but anywhere for a while.
Inspiring in his personal story or in his oratory?
In both, I think. But I actually think that the racism speech that he made after the remarks of Pastor Wright, you know, was actually perhaps the most brilliant and subtle, profound political mm-hmm. speech I could remember hearing. I mean, you know, in 20 years, 30 years,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. So,
I want to go back to The Enchantress of Florence a second. You've got a line in there: "The curse of the human race is not that we're so different from one another, but that we're so alike." What do you mean by that, and why is that a curse instead of a blessing?
Well, because we fight each other in the same way, you know. I mean, let's say we have all the same faults, you know. To be fair, that's not me saying it. It's a character of the novel saying it, and he means it somewhat ironically. So it's in the nature of a joke. Mm-hmm. But I think the truth in the joke is that we all have the same bad habits, you know, and those bad habits, when they come into collision with each other, create much of the world's conflict. But at the same time, there's a positive side to that as well, because I think our capacity for beauty, you know, and our capacity for nobility is also something we have in common with each other. So both the best and the worst of the human race, you know, is something we share. And I guess the simple point is that human nature is the great constant, and it's true east or west, 16th century or 21st century, that doesn't change that much.
And one of the things about human nature that you're saluting in The Enchantress of Florence is impudence and doubt and argumentativeness and
sensuality.
There's a lot of sex in this book, and
I'm happy to say that there is. Yes, there's probably more sex in this book than in all my books put together. I used to be very shy writing about sex, you know, it's kind of reticent. And if you look at Midnight's Children, for example, almost all the sexual scenes are really off stage, mm-hmm. or only very very briefly alluded to, but not in any direct way, very indirectly. And that's how I felt at the time, you know. And it's taken me all this time to get braver about it. Mm-hmm. And in this, the reason it came out in this book is that really the period in which it struck me as unusually sensualist. I mean, unusually openly hedonistic and sensualist. And so I thought, well, if that's what I think it was like, then I've got to go for it.
And why is it hard to write about sex?
Because it's kind of embarrassing. You know, it can be very corny. And so, I mean, and if it's gratuitous, then of course it's really wrong to do it, but for me it was just finding the reason to do it, if mm-hmm. you like. And as I say, for me the reason in this book was that it was a large part of the explanation of how people lived together in that time, the fact that they had this very open sexual culture, you know, mm-hmm. and it would have been wrong to ignore it.
Midnight's Children and The Enchantress of Florence and some of your other works are kind of odes to travel in their own way. And there's a tension in this book, as there is in some of the others, that, you know, the person who travels becomes deracinated, loses country. Yeah, absurdity and loneliness are the words that jumped out at me. Here's just one sentence. This was what was left of a human individual, and you took away his home, his family, his friends, his city, his country, his world, a being without context, and then it goes on from there.
Yeah, well, I think there are two kinds of characters in this book. There are the characters who in some way are defined by journeying, and who in many ways who discover themselves as by consequence of a journey. And there are other characters who think that's crazy, Why would you leave home? Why would you leave the place where everybody knows who you are and where you know your way around and where your life has meaning and go somewhere where none of that is true and nobody gives a damn about you? And I wanted that tension to be there.
And do you feel that in yourself? You've done a lot of traveling. You've
I feel the tension, yeah. I mean, I'm clearly one of the life's travelers. That's what's happened to me. But I kind of envy the homebodies, you know. I envy the people who just stayed put, including writers, including, you know, writers like Faulkner, for example, you know, or Eudora Welty, a lot of the writers of the American South, who just took one tiny patch of the earth and it was enough for a lifetime.
Not enough for you, though, or you don't have that option.
I don't have that option. Right. So you have to turn, you know, you have to try and turn to good account the options you do have. Mm.
In Midnight's Children, you have a line that repeats and that you said in an interview used to be the first line of the book. Mm. Most of what matters in our lives takes place in our absence. Mm. What do you mean by that?
Well, partly I mean in that novel that we are shaped by things that happen before we are born, you know, that the lives that your parents chose and made for themselves gives us a context into which we are born, which gives, you know, which opens up or closes various doors. You know, we don't have infinite possibility. We only have the possibilities we're born into. But it also, I think, increasingly what that line means is that many of the things that affect our individual lives are decisions and actions taken in rooms that we're never present in. You know, economic decisions, military decisions, political decisions. We don't even know the names of the people making the decisions, you know, and yet our lives are changed by them.
We're objects or subjects of those decisions. Mm-hmm. We're not the main actor. Yeah. There's a line here in The Enchantress of Florence on page 2 that I wanted to ask you about. Mm. It's about one of the main characters. If he had a fault, it was that of ostentation, of seeking to be not only himself, but a performance of himself as well.
Yeah.
Do you ever find that the performance of Salman Rushdie gets in the way of Salman Rushdie?
No, I don't perform myself. Other people perform me. I mean, there's an enormous amount of nonsense talked about me by people who have no idea who I am, and that is sometimes trying, you know, to be falsely described. But in the end, these books, you know, those are the things that describe me. And I think anybody who reads them really knows who I am.
And yet there's also another level to that, because in this book you talk about, you know, there are many different me's, many different aspects of one's personality that can't be pigeonholed.
Yeah, but it's not, that's what I'm saying. The consciousness of the person writing the book is constant, I think, in all my books. And I think if you read your way through even one of them, you become, because, you know, reading is such an intimate act that once you've read a book, you understand something about the sensibility and consciousness of the person who's made the book. And that's me. Mm. It's not a character in the book. It's not a line in the book. It's the sensibility out of which the book comes.
And that's the you that's going to live on.
Yeah.
Do you have another book you're writing? What's your next project?
I think I have to write a children's book, because I wrote Harun and the Sea of Stories for my older son when he was sort of 11, and now I have another 11-year-old who wants a book of his own. So I promised him that once I finished this book tour, I would address myself to that question. Mm. So I think that's next.
You can't cheat your kids.
No, you can't. They don't let you.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have today. My guest has been, of course, Salman Rushdie, author of Midnight's Children, and most recently, The Enchantress of Florence. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You've been listening to Progressive Radio. I'll be back next week with another guest. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.